You're listening to The Paul Higgins Show, the place for ambitious tech consultants scaling to live better. After 18 years as a global leader and having a successful tech consulting exit, I'm sharing what's working now to transform emerging tech consultants worldwide into trusted consultants that attract the best clients and deliver measurable results. When you're ready to level up your clarity, results, and freedom, begin with the free strategic profits blueprint available at paulhigginsmentoring.com/blueprint. You are building your tech consulting business and you have an exit in mind, but what levers should you be pulling? Hello, this is Paul Higgins and welcome to episode 531 of The Paul Higgins Show. In this podcast, Russ talks about his 14 years of experience in the Salesforce ecosystem and the last 4 years of he running his own Salesforce practice and what are those levers that you should be pulling right now. Russ Budget has over 20 years of experience in the software industry. He's had 14, as I just said, in the Salesforce ecosystem. He's very much focused on customer-trusted, value-driven approach, and this has been the key to his success working with experienced clients like Sony, Salesforce, P&G, Lilly, Harley-Davidson, and Roche Diagnostics, just to mention a few. You're going to love this conversation with Russ, and I'm going to now hand you over to Russ Budget from RadianHub.com. Great to have you here, Russ.
Thank you, Paul. I'm excited to, we've talked a couple of times offline. I'm very excited to be on your podcast.
Yeah, look, same. I've really enjoyed those. And like I said, it's going to be a similar conversation today, but just a lot more people listening. But why don't we kick off with who your ideal clients are and what problems you love to solve for them?
Yeah, sure. So ideally, an ideal client for us falls into one of our defined verticals. And those verticals quickly, ISVs, so independent software vendors who are looking for help with application development, app dev work, nonprofits or 501c3s, construction field service, and new to us is a vertical healthcare life sciences. Ideally, they'll fall within one of those vertical markets, but really what they're looking for is they're looking for some sort of digital transformation. Modernize their tech stack. They've outgrown point solutions. They're still using spreadsheets in some cases. In a lot of cases, actually, they're still using paper. We're there to help organizations modernize their digital footprint.
Right. So of the clients that you work with, majority aren't already on Salesforce?
That's a great question. I would say about 20% of them already are on Salesforce, have made that selection decision, and we're there to help them optimize what they're currently doing on the platform. But 70 to 75% of our clients are new to the platform itself. This is really a big transformation for them from a technology standpoint.
And given the fact that they're new to the platform, does that mean that the engagement is typically longer than normal? Like, tell us a little bit about what the difference is between when they're already on Salesforce versus new to Salesforce.
Yeah. So an existing Salesforce client, as I mentioned, is much more optimization. What are you already doing? How can we help you optimize that, create automations, maybe some integrations? So those project sizes, as you have indicated, are generally smaller. We'll say 6 to 8 weeks long, where a new Salesforce client who's making a shift from a legacy application or a point solution that they've outgrown is a much larger project. And that usually starts between, 14 to 16 weeks. There's a whole, transformation going on there where we at bare minimum want to take what they're doing in their legacy or existing solution and replicate it. But then hopefully on top of that, we're adding all type of new automations, innovation, and things that make the Salesforce platform optimally better for them.
Right. And as far as the change management piece, what are you doing? Because I think you listening to Russ and I have gone and implemented a lot of projects. I know that, there's still I think for ERP, there's a 75% fail rate that people sort of talk about for ERP. I think with what we're doing is normally slightly better, but it's still really difficult, right? So how do you guys handle this change management piece when someone is completely new to the platform or completely new to a new way of working?
Yeah, this is actually an excellent question and something that's very timely for us as an organization. I've been in the technology space my entire career, and I've been doing Salesforce consulting here now for about 14 years. And for the last 4 years, have owned my own consultancy and been growing it. So I've always known change management's not new. It's always been there. It's always been a concern. It's always been a risk. And it isn't until probably the third year of Radiant Hub, our third year in business, that we actually started to take it seriously, because we were noticing our projects were at greater risk. The adoption rate wasn't as good as we have would have liked. And the customer feedback on our projects wasn't as great as we would have liked because of the change management factor. We have put some things in place, starting at the pre-sales stage of a project, identifying key stakeholders, leadership that are going to be involved. Then during the course of our projects, we have introduced our training and technical documentation resources earlier, so that we're actually catering towards the culture and the style and the learning habits of the organization. We have just recently, I would say in the last years, really made change management part of our formal projects. And again, that's by introducing leadership and getting their buy-in, socializing what we're doing organizationally. You would not believe how many times we sell a project and the organization hasn't socialized it internally. And then those training and documentation services that we now offer, and we're offering more robust services on that front, have made a big impact in how the projects are received, how early they're adopted, and frankly, how quickly we get into the secondary phase of the roadmap and can keep things moving along.
And is it change management a part of everyone's role, or do you have defined change managers within the business?
Everybody has to be involved. But generally, as I mentioned, we pick a couple of executives that we need from the top down to be pushing this initiative and in socializing the importance of it. And frankly, using the systems that we put in place, right, from day one, being part of that process. And then there's always a set of project champions and power users and administrators who it's going to be their job or to takers of the system itself, that we implement a bunch of solutions, training guides, things of that nature to help them with their staff ultimately, and then the users of the system. And Paul, one of the things we try to identify is, from a user standpoint, who are the early adopters? We want to get one or two of those early adopters on board, but we also want to look for the laggards. Like, who are the people that were dragging their feet and really were doing okay with the old system, didn't understand why this new, you know, platform is being in place. So we try to socialize it with all the different kind of characters in the organization. We find when we include everybody and we get them to be promoting internally, leadership to be showing from the top down, and then you take those laggards who we really identify the laggards, the ones that don't want the system, and we try to make them champions. And that helps the process quite a bit.
Yeah. And within the customer themselves, does someone get pulled out of their role to be the champion, or is it something that's on top of their current day job, so to speak, to help with the transformation?
Yeah, I don't think so much that we pull them out of their role. I would say 9 times out of 10, a project champion surfaces in the first 3 or 4 conversations. It's the person going out and looking for the consulting partner that they're going to go on this journey with. And generally, they're interviewing 2 or 3 firms like ours to make that decision. And so I would say generally within the 2 to 3 conversations, we've identified who the project champion is. To answer the second part of your question, yes, it is generally above and beyond their daily roles and activities. It might be part of their job description somewhere, but it's not something that they, you know, when the project's not going on, that they're concentrating on. We try to take a lot of care in not, first we take a lot of care in project planning for how much time we'll need of that individual or set of individuals, also giving them expectations. And then we try to do a really good job to only pull them in when we need their feedback.
Right. And how many of the implementations you're doing, you're actually live on site versus remote?
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because previously, before Radiant Hub, as I said, I've been doing this for a lot of years. Going on site was really critical for those discovery whiteboarding sessions to really get the client's trust and to build that relationship. But Radiant Hub was founded February 9th of 2020. And I don't know if you remember what that was like at the time in February of 2020, but for us here in Indianapolis, Indiana, it was right before the pandemic happened. And so to kind of get back to your question, we're a virtual company. Now we do have a pool of resources in Indiana where we're headquartered, but we are spread throughout the United States. And it is a rarity for us to go on site and do anything from discovery to selling to training. You know, it's very rare for us to go on site. I would say in the last 8 to 10 months, we're seeing more of it. for our regional clients. But it really is a virtual world out there where we're doing most of this. I would say 85 to 90% of this remotely.
Yeah, and like you said, you've been in the game for 14 years within Salesforce ecosystem itself. You know, what are some of the key changes that you've had to make yourself and for the team to act or to be remote, virtual rather than in person?
Well, for me personally, I've been in this remote world working from home specifically for probably the last 15 to 17 years.
Yeah.
So for me, this was not new. And a lot of our work, or a good portion of our work, is development. And we have back-end developers doing a lot of that. You know, for them, that's not that different either, right? They were never really customer-facing anyways or on-site doing back-end ground-level development. What I'll say is that what we're doing right here with Zoom and some of the other collaboration tools we use, like Slack, which is a Salesforce acquisition, has become imperative. Not only using Zoom, but using some of the innovation, like recording the Zoom sessions, or they now have some AI companions for note-taking to help summarize the things. And then again, with Slack or some other collaboration channels that can be utilized, we really need to lean into those tools and assets so that we can present ourselves as if we're being on site. And then I think you paired that too with our clients aren't on site all the time either. A lot of them work 2 or 3 days in the office, or 2 or 3 days at home. It's not uncommon for the group, you know, if we have a boardroom full of people from a client standpoint, it's not uncommon for half of them to be dialing in remotely. So I think part of it's culturally, it's just shifted, and I don't think it'll go back. But then for us, we have to be flexible. We have to use these tools effectively. We have to be nimble enough to use our clients' tools if they're on a Microsoft stack or they're using Jira or something of that nature. But you really have to lean into those tools, in my opinion.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, you've had a great career with working for other consultancy businesses, you know, having a Salesforce practice within those. I think, you know, you worked for at least three of those. You know, what did you, when you decided to co-found the business with Doug, what did you take? What were the key learnings that you took from working within, you know, someone else's business to then start your own?
The very first Salesforce practice I helped co-found, the president of the organization at the time, what I've learned now is the president of the organization was building a company exactly like I wanted to build a company. And what that meant was, of course, client-centric, right? Do great work, and generally good things will come after that, right? More repeat business or referrals, but do great client work. And if you miss the mark on something, make up for it so much that the client forgot what you did to miss the mark on it. The other thing the individual did, the president of that company, he treated his people extremely well, created really good benefits, paid competitively, had good things for, personal time off and things of that nature. Created, you know, basically it was my first exposure to what a lifestyle business is, and treating his people really well, providing for them really well, thinking ahead for them, not just on the bottom line and his profits, but thinking ahead for the organization. Because in a professional service organization, your people are your product.
Yes.
And then also doing really good work for the clients. Those are two key takeaways. And I found myself when I was building Radiant Hub from the foundation up, along with my partner, Doug, what I found was I was replicating many of the things that I had observed and learned from that first Salesforce consultancy experience that I helped start.
Yeah, brilliant. And if you look at around the people piece, so what are some specific things that you're doing now to make sure? I think you've got, a team of 14. I think the last time we spoke, you're about the same number?
Very close. We're up to 15 now. So yeah, right. We just hired a new individual. One of the things that I enjoy doing the most is leadership. And some of the things that we're really concentrating on with our people is being, first off, cultures. People ask me, what's the most important thing about, you know, starting a company? And it's creating a great culture for our organization, for our employees. And the second question they'll be like is, well, what does culture mean to you? And it's something that's new to me on the leadership front is we try to be extremely transparent about everything we're doing. So I won't say I expose the team to everything, but I expose the team to a lot. I want them, as a small boutique company, I want them to know where, how stable we are. I want them to know what our strategy is. I want them to know the financials to a certain extent. I want them to know when things are going bumpy and we need, and we've had some situations over the last 90 days where we had to redefine process. I wanted them to know that when things were going bumpy. And what I found is by being more transparent and exposing our employees to those things, they become more vested in the organization itself. And retention of those employees is extremely important to me for long-term success.
And how are you transparent? So, you know, what does that look like?
So literally outlining once a month, we do a huddle, a company huddle, and we go over the previous month's numbers, successes, any painful things, projects were going on that we had to address. We literally put our goals up on the board by individual, rolling up all the way to the team, including the two founders, myself and Doug Porter, my partner. We are showing them where we would like to be and what that margin looks like and what that profitability looks like. And part of the reason we're doing that today is because in the second half of 2024, I want to tip us into what we're going to call a profit sharing model. So we're going to be a results driven organization, all the way from the two founders, all the way down to our leadership team, all the way down to every individual employee. And if the team collectively is hitting certain metrics, we're more profitable, they're exposed to those numbers, and everybody makes a little bit, you know, all boats rise, rising tide lifts all boats, right? That JFK quote. Yes. And that is the mantra. And again, what I'm finding is that gets every individual more invested into what they're doing on a daily basis, being vested in helping other teammates. So it's not all about the individual, it's about the team. And that rolls up into our deliverables and the success for our clients.
Right. And is that profit share purely based on metrics, or is there a behavioral piece to that as well?
As of today, and again, this will be new for us in the second half of 2024, it is a metrics driven profit sharing. However, every one of our individuals on our team are driven off of their utilization is the key metrics, right? But then also professional growth is a quick second. So we always have goals set for them. Where do they want to go professionally? You know, looking 12 months and beyond, and how, what do we need to do to help skill them up for that? What kind of behaviors do they need to improve on and things of that nature? The profit sharing piece to date, and you may have me thinking to reconsider that a bit, is purely metrics driven as of right now.
Yeah, and look, it's a difficult one to get the balance right, but I know that didn't flow when I was in corporate and then when we ran our own business around how do you measure those metrics? Because unfortunately, you know, some people can get the metrics without having the right behaviors. So just getting a balance of those. But once you bring in behaviors, then it becomes more subjective than objective. So there's always a balance. So maybe we'll watch this space and get your feedback on that. But I know that, you know, you and Doug set this business up, you're transparent. Eventually you want to potentially sell it. Like, I think that's one of the goals that you've been transparent about. Now, what are you doing, or are you doing anything different in your strategy based on the fact that you may exit the business versus if you're just running it from a day-to-day perspective?
You know, the last year and a half, I've been entertaining conversations from firms that might be interested in acquiring us. And these are just very early conversations. And you've turned me on. You've been kind enough to turn me on to some relationships of organizations that help or companies like mine get ready to be sold. I am monitoring some metrics, like in the Salesforce world and ecosystem, most acquiring companies are looking for at least a business of 5 million in sales. I've got a benchmark there, right? I know where we are today and going to be this year, hopefully, but I have a benchmark for where we need to be in sales. And I also know what our profitability number needs to kind of look like, right? From an EBITDA standpoint. Some of the other things that I've been really, really concentrating on, and by the way, in between where we are now and when we exit, it's perfectly fine if we run as a lifestyle business in this profit sharing model, making really nice margin and doing really good work. That's perfectly fine for me for a couple of years and for the team as well. But I do think when Doug and I started this, every single decision we made early on, from selecting who our professional employer organization, a PEO organization was going to be for benefits and HR. Like every decision we made was in the mindset of what will we look like from an acquiring company? And will it look messy or will it look really clean? And will the process be defined and optimized over time? Or will it be kind of loosey-goosey and hard to explain what our standard operating procedures are? And we haven't done a great job every time, but we've tried to be very intentional every time we make decisions from a scaling perspective, a business perspective, to try to think about what would an acquiring company look like? What would they see if they looked into our under our hood and saw our operations?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's really smart to do that. And I know you're also in a community where there's, you know, a lot of businesses have been bought and sold. I think you're in the ProServe community, which, you know, is for professional services business. What are some of the learnings that you've taken from a community, a peer community like that, to help you with this strategy?
So first off, it's a community, and you become comfortable in that community asking peers. Really, there are no silly questions, right? So you're talking to a bunch of peers that are all entrepreneurs. As you said, it's everybody's in the professional services space. Some of the companies are as big as 15, 20 million. Some of them are as small as, you know, 250,000 a year. The likelihood that you're going to be able to, and twice a week, we get into these forums. Some are small groups, some are larger presentation forums that are being driven by the members. So members are, which I think is imperative, right? Members are speaking all the time about their challenges, their problems. Really, it's just a really psychologically safe space to go in and ask, be like, we had a decent year last year. We're struggling with what we're going to give raises for our employees, merit increases, right? And we're struggling, and we have some thoughts on how to do it, but we'd like to hear how a handful of you are handling the same situation. I heard from two other co-founders in the ProServe space, and I was like, beautiful. I love that. That aligns with what we're trying to do. And now I know I'm not alone, and this is how other organizations are reacting to economic conditions. It's that type of reliability to go to some place and get some sound advice.
Yeah, yeah. And look, hear it at the start and the end, but you know, we've got a community that's, you know, dedicated just for tech consultants. So it's even more niched than what ProServe is, or niched. And you can find out more at paulhigginsmentoring.com/TC, where, but you know, I think the overall theme here is you don't have to do it all yourself, right? Even, you know, you're lucky that you've got Doug, so at least two of you, but a lot of you listening to Russ and I are by yourself. It's, you know, often you don't have to take the whole idea, but just get the stimulus from someone else and a different conversation that then helps you with your thoughts. And I think that's imperative in running your own business, and certainly encourage you to look at, you know, ProServe, reach out to Russ, he can give you his experience, and also look at our community, the Tech Collective, to get more help. But I just want to go back to that 5 million mark, which is 5 million top line revenue. And, you know, as a rough rule of thumb, if you haven't got all the processes in place, you might get 1x revenue. And if you've got everything in place and you've got a brilliant business, you might get 3x revenue is a rough rule of thumb of, you know, what's your business worth, right? It's only what someone's willing to pay, but that just gives you a bit of an indication. So on that 5 mil, I know that majority of your sales are coming through Salesforce and AEs, referrals from them. You know, is there anything specific that you've done that's worked really well to get more of those competitive deals within the Salesforce system?
Yeah, It's interesting, Paul. I was just having a conversation the other day with our marketing agency. So as you stated, about 80 to 85% of our leads come in through Salesforce account executives. So in a lot of ways, it's a channel model where we're co-selling. Salesforce no longer sells services. We don't sell licensing, but you bring us both together and you've got the total solution, right? What I was indicating to our marketing agency is, of course, we have two clients almost, if you think about it. The first client is obvious. It's the end user. It's the traditional client who we want to do a great job for. But the secondary client is the Salesforce regional vice presidents, the Salesforce area vice presidents, the 20 to 25 account executives that work underneath those AVPs and RVPs. And what we have to show those account executives in order to get to the bigger, more chunky, more complex, fun, profitable deals is consistency. We have to show them that also we can work within their sales cycle. We have to be nimble enough to know that when they're trying to herd the cats to get together for a discovery call, that we're have to be nimble enough to bring in the right resources to assist them. We have to stay ahead of the Salesforce innovations and always know what the latest and greatest solutions are doing, because that's what they're trying to sell and what they're graded on. So in an interesting way, our co-sell partners, the Salesforce account executives, we have to treat them almost like they're a customer as well. if we're getting good customer satisfaction reviews, 5-star reviews, that means good things for them. The likelihood of the client's not going to churn and renewals or upgrades are going to happen. In a lot of ways, we treat our Salesforce account executives as almost like their clients to us as well.
Yeah, and I know that for the sale, and one of the things that determine what that multiple revenue is the ability to source your own deals as well, right? So it's great that you've got Salesforce, but we all know that that can be a little risky and it's not always controllable. As far as you're controllable, I know that you're testing to develop your own lead source through an outsourced SDR company. What, you know, tell us a little bit of the pros and cons of using a company like that.
The pros are, as you stated, what I'd like to do is I don't want the Salesforce leads to turn off or slow down by any means, no. But I would like us to be a little bit more proactively, because in that vein, we're reacting to opportunities that are bringing to us. I would like us to be more proactive of generating opportunities ourselves. And so we are using a BDR firm, SDR firm on the West Coast. And the pros of it are they are generating new opportunities where we didn't have visibility before. They're not coming from Salesforce. And in this particular case, I have them driving into the new vertical, which we're trying to penetrate, which is healthcare life sciences. Every meeting they set up, every new opportunity they book for us is in a brand new vertical market. We're driving that activity. And we're the first entity to the sale. We get to kind of set the table, set expectations, understand everything. Then we get to bring in the Salesforce account executives, and they really appreciate that. The pros are they are generating and, you know, creating new opportunities for us in a specific new vertical market, which is great. The cons are it's really hard for them to be the voice of your company and to really understand your secret sauce, how you operate, where you're great, to develop objection criteria, right? How do you get around an objection from a potential prospect? And the downside is it's becoming pretty apparent. We'll test drive this for most of this year with the BDR firm, but it's becoming pretty apparent that I'm going to need to invest internally a full-time SDR or full-time BDR for us to, you know, to basically groom to be my replacement in the sales side of the house.
I think there's a role for it, definitely a role, but I think the majority of people, especially, you know, the sizes that we are, is I think that eventually leads to what you've just said, that conclusion. It's hard. It's nearly like it's too good to be true. And if it's normally too good to be true, it normally plays out that way. But I think, you know, it's good that you've tested it and you're taking your learnings from that. And I think those learnings from that can also help bed your own internal strategy. But look, Russ, you know, I really enjoyed talking with you. We could talk forever, but, you know, we've got to keep this show tight for you as the listener, because I know you've got many things that you're going to go and implement from what Russ has said and put into your business. We're going to give you time to do that. So what we're going to do now is go to the rapid fire. I'm going to ask you 4 questions and get rapid responses. Are you ready for that?
I think so.
Imagine stepping into a sales call and your potential client already knows and understands your expertise and is eager to engage with you. It sounds like a dream scenario, but with the right tool, it's entirely achievable. Introducing Tella.tv, Tella, your ultimate solution for personalized pre-sales videos. Tella TV empowers you to craft impactful video messages that resonate with your potential clients before you connect with them. One of the standout features of Tella is its seamless editing capabilities and automatic captioning, saving you time and ensuring your message is clear and accessible to all viewers. Ready to revolutionize your pre-sales process? Tella.tv today by visiting our resource page at paulhigginsmentoring.com/resources and clicking on Tella. Elevate your sales game with Tella, because your success starts before the call even begins. What are some of the daily habits you do to help you drive the success of Radiant Hub?
Yeah, I'm a consumer of information. I love consuming books. Right now I'm reading Buy Back Your Time. It's a fantastic book. I listen to podcasts like The Paul Higgins Show. I'm in the ProServe community that you mentioned earlier. And I have about 5 clients that I have kind of an informal board where I spend time with the CEO and they spend time with me, and we talk about the industry from both sides of the coin, right? I just love consuming information, and that's one of the things I do to stay on top.
Brilliant. Well, I think that sort of covers the next one is, you know, where do you go to find out the information? I think you've answered that brilliantly. So we'll skip to the third one, which is what's a wish we could grant Radiant Hub right now?
I would love a steady state for about 90 days, right? We're coming off of 3 years of triple digit growth, and it's fantastic. And but things are always changing, Paul, and we're always having to adapt to it. And if I could wave a magic wand, I would love things to just be at a steady state for about 90 days. Let me, just iron out all those processes and eke out all that profitability and get the project schedule clean. That's not how life works, but I would love calm waters for give me 90 days of calm water, and I would thoroughly enjoy that.
Great, great. And then the last one is, like you said, you started in 2020, right before the pandemic, an incredible time to start a business. But what have you learned now that you wish you had known earlier?
Funding, 2020, we worked for half a year. It was just me and my partner, Doug. Literally, that was just the two of us. 2021, we were doing more business, and we had to bring on some contractors. But it wasn't until the end of 2021 where I went and got official funding and through SBA loans that the following year we grew 400%. There was a direct correlation between us getting the type of funding needed to scale. I didn't know that maybe there was a bit of imposter syndrome going on a little bit. I didn't think the banks would invest in something that we had going on. And what I found is, a good business plan, a good presentation to the bank, and they want to help you. So yeah, most no doubt the fund dipping in and getting help with funding would have been something I should have done earlier.
Brilliant. Well, look, you've been listening to Russ and it's episode 531, but you can go and find out more about him at radianthub.com. He's got all his links there, including a call if you want to schedule a call with him and, ask more detail around whether that's the last piece, the funding, or other things that he said. As you can tell, Russ is very knowledgeable, but he's also very kind in sharing his knowledge as he has today. And also, you can go find him on LinkedIn. All of those links will be in the show notes. But Russ, I really appreciate you coming on today.
Anytime, Paul. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
What a great interview with Russ. He's got so much experience and wisdom, and he will openly share that with you. So please reach out to him, whether it's around his client-centric approach, his people and his culture that he spoke about, his profit share, which you can tell that he's still got the training wheels on, but he's going to implement this year. So you can take some learnings from that. And finally, his experience with outsourced sales, and I think he's now planned to bring it in-house. But reach out to him, let him know that you heard him here on the Paul Higgins Show. Reach out on his LinkedIn, which the link is in the show notes. Also, reach out and mention this to peers. So those that are gearing up for sale that you know within your network, share it with them. They'll think you're an absolute rock star for doing so. And it's always great to help others. Check out our solo shows, and I'll see you next time on the Paul Higgins Show. Time for action. Subscribe, comment, and let me know what you like best about this episode. Plus, get the Strategic Profits Blueprint at paulhigginsmentoring.com/blueprint.